It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Every number tells a story, and that's especially true for the numbers on sports jerseys.
Sports Illustrated just published Any Given Number, a rating of the best players for each uniform number from 00 to 99 for all sports.
For example, of all the athletes who shared the number 4 jersey, who would be rated best? Was it Brett Favre or somebody else? To help start some arguments, we have Sports Illustrated staff writer Stephen Canella with us. He co-edited Any Given Number, Who Wore It Best from 00 to 99. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, looking at which athlete wore it best, you have the difficult apples to oranges thing here. How do you compare the great football players, basketball, hockey, baseball, soccer? How do you compare across sports like that?
Yeah, it's difficult. And we do these books thinking we're going to settle a lot of arguments, and I think basically we created 100 new ones. Really, at its heart, this is a fun book, and it's a fun debate, and there is no way to compare what a baseball player does to what a football player does to what a basketball player does, et cetera. But, we went into this thinking, who is most identified with the number? If you went number by number and had to pick the one athlete who you instantly associate most with that number for their excellence on the field, and also as sort of pop culture icons, that was our basic criteria going in. So as you can tell, we really narrowed it down.
It sounds like it was a lot of fun. It probably started arguments. Did it end any friendships behind the scenes there?
No friendships ended. Maybe strained would be a way to put it. We did have a lot of fun putting this together. It was Bill Sykin, one of our writers, and I were sort of the main organizers of this, but we spent a lot of time canvassing opinion of people we work with and people we don't work with. People who are our friends out in the field and our fellow sports fans. I mean, that's really what we're hoping this book is just these sort of the ultimate sports bar debate. These are the kind of things that fans talk about, and they're fun to debate, even if there is no right answer and there's no wrong answer.
Well, I'm sure you're going to get some angry feedback, and let's start here in Wisconsin with number 4.
Yeah,
Brett Favre, legend. Packers quarterback is in your debate section for number 4. He didn't win, though.
He did not, and Brett had the unfortunate task of going up against really an all-time great in any sport. Now, yes, Wisconsin fans, Brett Favre is an all-time great himself, but Bobby Orr is someone who really revolutionized the sport of hockey. He changed the way the game was played. He transcended the NHL and became sort of a cultural icon in his own right in the 1970s, both for one very famous picture of him flying across the ice after he scored the game-winning Stanley Cup-winning goal in 1972. As great as Brett Favre's resume was, we felt he didn't quite measure up to Bobby Orr, but he made the list of finalists, which is still pretty good.
Well, you make the point, while Brett Favre may have been a great within the game, Bobby Orr as a scoring defenseman changed the way the game was played.
Absolutely. He played, before Bobby Orr came along, defensemen were just that, defensemen. They weren't expected to be offensive weapons. Bobby Orr, in addition to being a terrific defensive player, played offense, almost as well as Wayne Gretzky did. He skated with a kind of flair and fluidity that we really hadn't seen from defensemen to that point in hockey. And you can draw a direct line from the way Bobby Orr plays to the way someone like P.K. Subban does now for the Montreal Canadiens, a great offensive threat from the defensive end.
Well, now the soccer, the rest of the world calls it football, World Cup is coming up, and that takes us to number 10, a number strangely dominated by soccer. There are soccer number 10 jerseys springing up in my house as everybody took me a while to learn his first name because all the kids in my kid's school just call him Messi, Lionel Messi. But he's not the soccer player who won in the number 10 slot.
No, you got to go. I mean, as great as Lionel Messi is, I think I'm saying his name correctly there.
I'm probably not.
as great as Messi is, and another guy who wore number 10, Diego Maradona, another all-time soccer or football great, neither of them quite measures up to Pele, a guy who not only was an incredible player, but I think even more than Messi and Maradona became sort of an international, cultural figure. The name Pele still resonates today. He's still, he was on The Daily Show a few weeks ago. This guy is still, when people think soccer in this country, Pele is often the first name they still think about. And he's one of those, we often talk about athletes or people who reach the level of being, someone you use to describe others. You're the Michael Jordan of doctors or something like that. People still use the phrase. He's the Pelé of doctors. He's the Pelé of writers. He's a standard of excellence that people understand, even if you're not a huge soccer fan.
Well, let's move up to a number that I imagine you didn't have a lot of debate about, the number Michael Jordan wore, number 23. Was this a slam dunk?
Absolutely. And there were a few numbers like that. 23 is instantly recognizable as Michael Jordan's, 99 instantly recognizable as Wayne Gretzky. We were happy to get to those numbers because we didn't have to spend a whole lot of time
fighting.
Debating those. There were no friendships strained over that.
There's a story I didn't know behind how he picked that number.
Michael Jordan's number. He basically cut a number in half from high school, I believe. And it's funny how he just some numbers just become iconic in their own right, so much so that when he came back after his brief retirement and his dabbling with baseball, he switched to 45 for a brief time, and partly that was because he wanted to kind of start a new life for himself and didn't want to have to live up to the status he set as a number 23.
It's interesting what numbers can mean to the players. You mentioned Jaromír Jágr from the world of hockey. He's from Czechoslovakia and picked the number representing the Prague Spring and the year his father died after being jailed in that uprising. You also talk about sometimes players bribing each other to get numbers from them.
Yeah. This is the other great thing about uniform numbers is just how intensely personal they are. They're personal as fans, and that you always remember the numbers of your favorite players when you're growing up. But the players take this completely seriously themselves. And there's sort of a cottage industry in professional sports of players sort of getting traded to a team where a number they've had their whole career might already be taken. And so there has to be some horse trading to try to get that number with the new team. So we've heard guys who get paid in gold watches, get paid in cash. My favorite is the pitcher who lived out in Arizona, and he demanded the teammate build him an outdoor kitchen to give up his number for it.
We've got a caller on the line. We've got John in Windsor with an issue to bring up. John, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I was wondering, like a guy like Oscar Robertson, who was inferentially the best basketball player of all time, he had two numbers. He had number one when he was with Milwaukee Bucks, and I'm not sure. I think he had like number 33 or number 35 when he was with the Cincinnati Royals. So what did you do with a guy like that?
They were tricky. There were a lot of players like that. Basically, we went with the number that a player wore for the majority of his career, or where he had sort of his most success, or where you would reasonably most identify the prime of his career with that number. So another guy like that was Otto Graham, who wore a couple different numbers, and some of these, there were several players. Shaquille O'Neal is one of them who have worn three or four numbers, and you can make a case for him at several of those numbers, and they sort of hurt their own arguments by not having a full career at one particular number. Shaq is one guy who sort of cost himself at a couple spots by switching numbers so often.
And LeBron James lost to Bill Russell and Michael Jordan in both the numbers he's worn.
Exactly. Although if we do this book in 10 years, LeBron might overtake one of those guys.
Well, was there one that broke your heart as you're going through this? Is there one that you wanted your guy on top of the list for a number and just didn't get it?
Well, 32 was kind of our among our most difficult numbers, only because someone was going to have to be an unfortunate loser at that. Our candidates there are Sandy Koufax, one of the all-time great pitchers, Magic Johnson, arguably, he's on the short list of the greatest NBA players ever, and Jim Brown, arguably the greatest NFL running back ever. We ended up going with Jim Brown, so, it seems a shame to do a book like this where someone like Magic Johnson and Sandy Koufax doesn't get to be a winner. This might be the only time they didn't win anything, but the heartbreaking thing for me there was my favorite player growing up was the pitcher for the Phillies, Steve Carlton, also wore 32. I would have loved to get him some love at some point in this book, but he barely even enters in the conversation at 32.
All right, well, lots of other conversations will come from this book. Steven, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Sports Illustrated staff writer Steven Canella. He's part of the team that put together the book we've been talking about. It's called Any Given Number, Who Wore It Best from 00 to 99. The news broke earlier this week that the last unaccounted for service member from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan had been freed in exchange for 5 Guantanamo Bay detainees.
The reaction to Bo Bergdahl's release has been swift and divisive, to say the least, and many are lining up to express their anger over the release of a POW who many consider to be a deserter. But it's also raising questions over the ethics of warfare and whether or not the country has an obligation to bring him back, regardless of the circumstances.
Here with us now to talk more about this story is Alex Berenson. He's an author and former reporter for the New York Times, where he covered the wars. He recently wrote an op-ed for the paper, A Prisoner of War, But Not a Hero. Alex, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. It's good to talk to you.
So there's been a lot of talk, a lot of reaction to this news this week. But what was your first reaction when you heard the news that this deal had been struck, that he was being released?
Well, my first reaction, I should say, it was probably a bit of a, it may come as a bit of a surprise. I sort of immediately thought of the first novel that I wrote, because that features a guy who's been in Afghanistan for a really long time and comes home, and all my books have been around the same character. So I've been sort of following this from a slightly different take, because, you know, I have my own weirdly fictional character in mind. But very rapidly, I started to think more seriously about what the implications were, and the fact that this man, was essentially being lionized by the administration. Although they didn't call him a hero, but they did have this ceremony in the Rose Garden where his parents, you know, showed up, and they seemed to expect a lot of praise for what had happened. And since I've been sort of paying attention to this, for a couple of years, and certainly since the Rolling Stone had a very long piece about it in 2012, and about the issues around his disappearance, I thought to myself, you know, this is not going to go as they expect. Although I have to say the level of backlash and anger has surprised me a little bit.
What do you think leads to that anger? And actually, we probably need to take this into a few different pieces.
Yeah, I realize that was a really long.
Go out for half an hour there. No, but the circumstances surrounding Bo Bergdahl's capture seem to be triggering a lot of the backlash here. What is it about this story that has made people so upset?
So start with that. The fact is that he seems to have walked off the base. If you believe his colleagues, and if you believe really what his parents, you know, when they were talking publicly about this, which they're not so much now, but when they were talking to Rolling Stone about it, they received emails from him saying, I'm not happy here. I'm not happy with what we're doing here. I'm leaving. And then he just disappeared. So from the beginning, his capture was shrouded in this mystery of how he was taken. He certainly was not taken in a firefight where his position was overrun, and you imagine a lone survivor type situation. It was nothing like that. He appears simply to have left. So that's why there are these allegations that he is a deserter.
Right, and this has not been established in a legal way, but the sense of fellow troops, veterans in particular, is that, call it that legally or not, he deserted. He deserted his platoon, his fellow soldiers.
Yes, and if you look at this, at the plain language of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, Article 85, which covers desertion, he appears to meet those grounds. Now, there's also being absent without leave. To be absent without leave, you have to intend to come back, and there's no indication that he intended to come back. So you know, again, this is not for me to judge, and it certainly hasn't been proven in a court of law. And if he is ever charged, obviously he gets a court martial, and he gets to be tried by his peers. But the word, you know, in public interviews that his fellow soldiers are making is desertion.
Well, the White House has been making the case that you leave no soldier behind. And I guess the question that arises is, does that apply no matter whether the soldier was captured, as you said, when his position was overrun, when she was caught up in a firefight, or if they went away from the Union, were AWOL, were maybe deserting?
Yes. I mean, in my opinion, I think that it's foolish to say, whatever the circumstances of his departure, that we shouldn't try to bring him back. He's not he's not subject to the Taliban's justice system. He's subject to the American and the American military justice system. And among other things, you don't want to try him in absentia. You want him, if ultimately he's found competent and if ultimately the Pentagon decides to bring charges, military prosecutors decide to bring charges, he's got to have the right to stand trial if he wants. And that means bringing him back. So for that reason, if for no other, he should be brought back. But I think there are other reasons, too. I think the idea of leaving an American in the hands of a force that's brutal, that's been known to decapitate prisoners, that we fought against for 15 years or 13 years, I think that the administration was correct to try to bring him home. The mistake that they made, in my opinion, is they wanted to get points for this rather than to recognize the murk around this. And instead, they stepped into this incredible mess where there is, this whole second set of issues, which is, should we have released these Taliban for him?
Right. That's what I wanted to move to next.
Yes. And so I don't necessarily have a problem with that. The Taliban, unfortunately, like it or not, are going to be a part of the political structure in Afghanistan going forward. And the people who we released, we call them commanders. The Taliban would call them ministers. Okay. And to say that they're terrorists, it's sort of like Sinn Féin and the IRA. At some point, you have to recognize, or we have to recognize, that the Taliban speak for a part of the Afghan population, and we're going to have to deal with that. And we can't keep people who are essentially government officials locked up forever. So I don't have a problem with that either, although I understand why the Republicans are making hay with it. What Pardal clearly has become in the last 48 hours is he's become a way for us to talk about whether we won this war, whether we lost this war, whether it was worth the price we paid, all these questions that we haven't wanted to discuss in the last really 3 or 4 years, especially the last two as the war has been winding down, this man has become this incredible focus of.
And part of the negotiations that apparently Qatar, the nation, was helping with between the U.S. and Taliban, initially it may have been a wider negotiation about the Taliban's place in the future of Afghanistan. It got narrowed at some point to what are we going to exchange for this POW? Why do you think that got narrowed so much to just this one American?
Well, I think if I were in the Taliban's position, I wouldn't want to be having negotiations with the United States because we're leaving. And once you have no boots on the ground, once we have no boots on the ground, we don't get to tell the Taliban not to come back to Afghanistan unless we're going to be trying to pick them off with drones. And, that strategy, has limited effectiveness. It has some effectiveness, but has limited effectiveness. So I think the Taliban are content at this point to sort of wait us out. I think probably they saw a great opportunity here, as their commanders have been quoted as saying, this legitimizes us. The United States dealt with us. We released this man. We did make a video, of ourselves cutting his head off. We are suddenly a more legitimate political force to the whole world than we were before this happened. So I think that's why the Taliban did it. And I think the administration wanted to get him home, probably saw an opportunity here to score political points and didn't realize how badly this would blow up.
Well, and people are weighing the calculus there. On the one hand, the release of these five Taliban commanders, ministers, whatever they may be, the legitimization claimed by Taliban, all that in exchange for someone who may have deserted his unit. That whole combination, is that firestorm there making people particularly upset?
I think it is. And then on top of that, there's the story. I've been amazed because the story has actually gotten bigger each day since Saturday, which in this age of instant news cycles is unusual. But I think it's a combination of all these very important issues and then the mystique of the POW coming home, which comes out of Homeland, which frankly I'd like to think comes a tiny bit out of my novels. This idea of the guy who comes home and what did he know? And, has he been turned? What did he tell them? What can he tell us about them? So, Bo Bergdahl is a fascinating figure in and of himself, and he speaks to all these anxieties.
We're talking with author and former reporter Alex Berenson about the Bo Bergdahl release. It's been dominating the headlines this week, getting all kinds of reactions as the story moves along.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. What do you think about the prisoner swap? Was the U.S. right to negotiate for Bergdahl's release? And now that he's coming home, how do you think he should be received? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Alex Berenson about the release of Bo Bergdahl, who is the last remaining American POW in the war in Afghanistan. And we want to hear from you. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did the Obama administration do the right thing, exchanging Taliban prisoners, five of them, for the release of Bo Bergdahl? Are you troubled by the stories you're hearing that he may have left his post? Does that mean we should have left him in Taliban hands, or should we still have work to secure his release? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org. Alex, another thread that we hadn't picked up before the news there. We've heard suggestions that this could send the message to people in the Taliban, to Al-Qaeda affiliates around the world. Hey, capture American soldiers. You can use them as bargaining chips in the future. And in fact, someone with the Taliban, I believe, said exactly that. Is that a factor that's going to come back to haunt President Obama?
No, I think that's always been true. I mean, American soldiers, Americans in general, they're prized. You know, they're valuable. They're valuable. You can sell them. I mean, you can sell captured Americans. You can trade them, certainly soldiers. And in some case, I don't know if we would trade, anyone at Guantanamo for an American civilian. But no, the idea that suddenly they've woken up and realized that Americans are valuable to have as hostages is ridiculous.
And you mentioned looking at this as a novelist, and it seems like there's this bizarre narrative going on and all sides in the United States scrambling to control how the story is told. What do you make of that, of their efforts to do that?
Well, it's the culture we live in. It's always been true, though. It's a story that gets people's attention, and the Republican Party certainly sees a chance to score points against the beaten down president with this. There's been reports that they've put media, reporters in touch with people in Bergdahl's platoon to, talk about him and talk negatively about him. As long as those soldiers are telling the truth and they're not being pressured, that's just part of the game. And I don't necessarily even have a problem with the fact that the GOP is doing that. Both sides are going to try to spin this to their advantage. Again, that's another reason probably that the administration erred so badly, because even if Bergdahl is a deserter and is eventually jailed, this has got to be a very difficult time for him. And who knows what he is or is not seeing and hearing right now, but he should have been put on a plane. This should have been announced in one paragraph, and it would be at least we'd still be having elements of this debate. But it would at least be a little bit less personal about him. And so I really do fault the administration for doing that.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got John on the line in Milwaukee. John, hi.
Hi. Very, very, very educated guest, I believe, there. I'd like to thank him. I think I got two questions. One is... are the Taliban, should they be treated as prisoners of war and not terrorists, or both, or they could be terrorists or a prisoner of war? Because, I mean, they were a recognized government of Afghanistan. We invaded them when they wouldn't turn over bin Laden unless they we showed evidence that he was guilty of 9/11. So, but therefore, we invaded them. They're soldiers, and they're people that are military. Shouldn't we treat them as prisoners of war and not lock them up like they do it at Guantanamo and other bases around the world?
Interesting point, John. So we're not negotiating with terrorists. In effect, these are prisoners of war. May not like the side that they fought on, but this is what happens during war, I guess he's saying, Alex.
Yeah, no, and that's a very, you know, that's a very good question. There are all kinds of people in Guantanamo, right? There are people who are clearly, you know, terrorists who worked for Al Qaeda, who are members of Al Qaeda. There are also Taliban, Afghans, who, you know, are they were, the Taliban was not the representative of the Afghan state for all those years, you know, all of the last 13 years. So it's pretty easy for us to say, you know, essentially they're stateless. We don't want to repatriate them. They'll just go back to the battlefield. When there is no more battlefield because we're not there anymore, and when and if the Taliban take their place, you know, in an Afghan government, I think it gets pretty hard to argue that, you know, senior members of that government should be imprisoned indefinitely. If we want to try them for crimes against the United States, you know, as we tried, you know, certain Nazis after World War II, we can do that. But at some point, you can't just say we're going to hold you as combatants when there's no more war. So it is a very complex question.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Ron on the line in Medford. Ron, hi.
Hi there. Hey, I'm 55 years old, and I remember back.
Ron just dropped off there. Sorry, Ron. I think he was calling to say that he didn't like the deal. We'll go now to Larry with us in Madison. Larry, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if the administration did any consulting with the Israelis who have faced these situations frequently, and what comparison our guest sees or similarities and differences between the situations that have been in the
news. I don't know if they did or did not consult with the Israelis. The Israelis, you know, just a couple of years ago, traded 1,000 prisoners for one prisoner of war. So the notion that, you know, the Israelis would never have done this, that's clearly inaccurate. And the fact is, we say, oh, we don't negotiate with terrorists. You know, President Reagan said that, and less than 3 years later, he was negotiating with Iran over Iran-Contra. We negotiate when it's in our interest to negotiate. It's that simple. It doesn't matter who's on the other side. And in this case, you know, we wanted to bring this guy home. So this notion of we never do X or we never do Y, you know, that's right up there with the check is in the mail as the biggest lie around.
Larry, thanks a lot for bringing up that international perspective. I will go now to Joe in Hillsboro. Joe, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I guess my immediate reaction, I have a daughter in the Peace Corps in West Africa, and contrary to what your guest is saying, is that was my concern, is that we have changed the dynamics in that although we may have privately done negotiations, not so much hostage exchanges, now it's very, very public. And I, that was one of my first concerns is, you know, some of the extremists there might think, oh, here we go.
Well, it's interesting you say that because, you know, I've got a public webpage and I sort of solicited information about this because a lot of my readers are military readers or, you know, U.S. government readers. And, you know, I try to have conversations with them. It's an interesting way to reach out and talk to people. And somebody who I think was former Peace Corps said he was happy about this. He was happy to know that the government would reach out, you know, and try and go to great lengths to get him back. I obviously there's a 99.99% chance that your daughter's stint in the Peace Corps will be untroubled, but I think you should be happy to know that the U.S. government will go to great lengths to get her back if something happens to her.
Joe, thanks for the call. Best of luck to your daughter. Alex, as we start to wrap up, Bo Bergdahl himself, the hero's return narrative is something that isn't happening. His hometown has canceled a welcome home ceremony, worried about security, worried about angry reactions to this. But what happens to him now? Do you think the military will be looking at possible charges of desertion?
I think they're going to have to. I think they have no choice but to do so. And by the way, it's possible he's simply mentally incompetent. Mm-hmm. It, you know, either now or even, you know, when he walked off. What he did was so close to suicidal that there is an argument to be made that even if he, you know, even if he thought he was deserting, that we just can't try him. But he's going to have a difficult integration process into the United States. It's going to be very, and everything that's happened in the last week has only made it harder for him. That, you know, again, when just to go back to these these novels. One of the genesises was I had been in Iraq and I came home and I was struck by how difficult it was just for me as a civilian reporter to come back to the United States. And I imagine this character, John Wells, who'd been in Afghanistan, you know, for 5 or 6 years, trying to come home and getting used to the consumerism, to the culture of the United States again, and how hard that would be. And this man is going to have, you know, it's going to be 100 times as hard for him because there's all this controversy around him.
You mentioned the issues that we don't talk about on the list, probably the people still in Guantanamo. You mentioned, you know, what we left behind in Afghanistan. Do you hope that the issue of homecoming for veterans will be one of the issues we talk about when the dust settles from this Bo Bergdahl case?
You know, on some level, I'd say no, because this is so unique, and I think a lot of veterans don't want to be lumped in to his homecoming in any way.
Alex, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
That was Alex Berenson. He's an author, a former reporter for the New York Times. His recent op-ed for the paper was called A Prisoner of War, But Not a Hero. In this week's Share Something segment, we are going to share some great summer reads. More to the point, you are going to share some great summer reads. We're looking for your input. Now that Memorial Day is behind us, the pools are open, the beaches, well, it's warm enough to head to a lot of them. Summer is here, all but officially. But what to read?
So this moment, we're going to start compiling our summer reading list, and we want you to help. What are you reading this summer? We're just talking to our board operator, Brittany, and she says it's a great time to reread things. Well, do you have a book that you turn to every summer? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Do you like a thriller? Do you like it to be a little bit lighter? What makes a great summer read and what is tops on your list? You can also send us an email to talk@WPR.org, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Yeah, so the Harry Potter series, that was Brittany's summer rereading suggestion, actually. Is there something that you like to go back to in the summer season? 800-642-1234 is the number to call and share your favorite summer reads. We were talking a little bit, Veronica, before the show. I like a big, meaty science fiction book for my summer reading to take along with me, something that's going to really keep me engaged. I recommend Alistair Reynolds is one of my favorites. I wish I had never read anything by him so I could read him for the first time again. A couple good points of entry. Chasm City is one. And House of Suns. He's a guy who thinks big, like at one point, two galaxies colliding in 10 million years is a major plot point in a novel. This is big stuff, I tell you.
All right. Well, you know what? We've got some callers on the line, and you can join them at 800-642-1234 and share your summer read. We're going to go to Paul joining us in Green Bay. Hi, Paul.
I called up to recommend Dandelion Wine. I haven't read it for a few years, but for quite a while, I used to read it every spring just to get in the mood for summer.
I've heard of that one. What is it about?
It's kind of a story of the author, Bradbury, growing up in Greentown, Illinois. And it's sort of a coming-of-age story. It's got a little fantasy in it, and it takes place over the summer.
And that's why it says summer reading to you. It fits the climate.
It fits the climate, and in addition to that, one of the things that he talks about is the joy, and I remember this so well, of getting your summer tennis shoes, and all of a sudden you can run fast and jump high and do amazing things that last year's shoes just didn't have anymore.
All right. Thanks.
That's just one part of it.
Thanks a lot for the call, Paul. That sounds like a great suggestion. Now, how about you? We are looking for your input, your suggestions for a great summer read. Maybe what's on your shelf to read this summer, or something that you've read in the past, want to reread, or that you would recommend somebody take with them on a vacation. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. 800-642-1234.
And we're going to go next to Chris, who is with us in Mauston. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
What is your vote?
My recommendation is Burning Chrome by William Gibson. It's a collection of short stories by him. He's the original science fiction author who coined the genre of cyberpunk within science fiction.
So here's my possible objection, Chris, to William Gibson. It's a little brainy and maybe depressing sometimes. What do you say to that?
Well, it all depends on the short story. He's actually had quite a few interesting ones. One of them that I particularly like is the Grinsback Continuum, where he kind of gives an alternate future of America.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Chris, and the recommendation.
Appreciate the call, Chris. And while we get some of these other callers on the line, and we do have one open line, though, by the way, for you, 800-642-1234. I picked a book. Actually, my daughter grabbed a book from a little free library, and it was a Nora Blackbird mystery, which I'd never read, and it was one in the middle of the series. But those are really delightful to read in the summer. They're light, they're fun. I don't like things that are going to be too heavy or depressing, as you said. And it's just a joy to read, like something that will keep you turning the pages. To me, that's a summer read.
That sounds good. The Dead After Dark, the books that True Blood was based on.
Right, Charlene Harris.
Charlene Harris, thank you. Those are, and it's in a hot place, right? Louisiana.
Right.
So it does, even though it's always summer there.
And she's always tanning in her yard. Right. Those are great summer reads, too. All right, we're going to go back to the phones and talk to Solomon in Mequon. Hi there.
My recommendation is actually by a Wisconsin author named Patrick Rothfuss, The Name of the Wind and A Wise Man's Fear, a three-book series that he's released.
Right. Well, you don't have to sell Rob and I on that. We are converts already. Those are fantastic. Those are thick books. I don't know. Does it take you a whole summer to read that, Solomon?
No, about a week and a shot. But once I pick them up, I can't put them down. And I'll reread them three times. So.
Wow.
Oh, they hold up to rereading, because that's another one I was thinking, oh, I wish I could erase those from my mind so I could encounter them for the first time again. But you get something when you pick them back up.
Well, a little bit something new, you know, the little details that you miss on the first, you know, one or two reads that are subtleties in his personality and things that he writes into the story, which I enjoy every time.
All right. Well, thank you a lot for that call. We're going to go next to Juan in Boscobel. Hi, Juan.
Hi, I recommend this this little teenager novel. It's called Hatchet by Gary Paulsen. It's about this teen named Brian who he flies to Canada to visit his family who live in the oil fields in Canada, and then his plane crashes, unfortunately, and all he has to survive is his hatchet, and it's just this, like, it's filled with mystery, filled with wild animals. You have to read it. It's like it keeps you on your seat, and it's a great summer read.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. I like the edgier seat factor there. Mm-hmm. And young adult fiction is actually, I think, the perfect genre for summer reading, too.
Definitely.
Yes, I agree.
Thanks a lot, Juan, for the suggestion. We've got Susan now in Appleton with us. Susan, hi. You're on the air.
Hello. I would recommend a riveting summer read. It's a mystery, and it's written by Gillian Flynn, and it's called Gone Girl. And I read it, and I was just so engaged with the characters. They really took me into the book right away. And I also right away recommended it to my husband, who is not that avid of a reader but loves mysteries too. And he was just – and so we were both had a great conversation from it. So if you're looking for a guy, girl, wonderful mystery that you're not going to figure it out, this is it.
Yeah, I've heard about that one. That's gotten a lot of buzz around it. Is it really dark, or is it something that will be a page-turner but not be too heavy?
It keeps you thinking and thinking and thinking. But it's not too dark, but it's going to keep you hanging. You're just going to be like wanting. It's a page turner, definitely.
All right.
But make sure you put on that sunscreen when you're out in the sun reading it.
Good advice. Thanks.
Yeah, the mystery genre, you gave a mystery suggestion earlier, seems like a great prime summer read because they tend to keep you turning the pages.
Right. It shouldn't feel like a chore to read in
right.
the summer. You shouldn't have to force yourself to turn the next page because it's virtuous. You have to turn the next page.
Definitely. I might revisit one that says Summer to Me, Robert Graves' I, Claudius series. I remember reading it in the summer and sitting at home and drinking Faygo or making Faygo floats.
What's Faygo?
It's a soda. It's a Michigan thing, man. Red Pop or Rock and Rye. And that
is it, like
it was
Pim?
Summer. That's one of my great summer reading memories anyway.
Sounds more like a Faygo memory.
Well, that too. I haven't had Faygo in years. I wonder if the book would be as good without it.
Enough about Faygo. Let's go back to the phones. We're going to talk to Jordan in Galena, Illinois. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, good afternoon. A book that I want to read this summer is To Kill a Mockingbird. I was forced to read it back when I was in high school, when I was 15, and doing teenage stuff back then, and actually just graduated from college today, and I really think that's probably a real important book to know and understand.
Oh, that's fantastic, and congratulations, by the way. But that's a really interesting perspective, so summer might be a good time to look at something with fresh eyes that you read when you were younger.
Jordan, well, I hope you enjoy that reread. We'll go now to Aaron in Sturgeon Bay. Aaron, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and I guess this is to readers like Rob Ferret. First is reread. I got two of them. A reread is Brian Greene's Elegant Universe. It's a great book describing string theory, and it goes over Einstein's theories. It's a very easy-to-read book, great book for the summer. And another one I like, Rob, you might like this, called Alien Interview, edited by Lawrence Spencer. And you like science fiction.
Oh, yeah.
Well, here's a mystery. We don't know if this is fiction or fact. It's the alien transcript, the alien interview transcripts from the Roswell crash, possibly.
Oh, interesting. And it's presented in a factual way.
Yes. He was delivered these documents, and he published them as they were.
Interesting. Aaron, thanks a lot for sharing those. This might be fun to check out this summer. And Elegant Universe was the other one on string theory. Sound like
that's a fascinating one. I've read that one. It's terrific.
Oh, you have?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so lots of science-y things, science fiction, wonderful things to dig our reading chops into this summer.
Yep, and Daniel in Maquonago, one more quick call. Daniel, what's your recommendation?
I just wanted to recommend The Hobbit, especially with the last movie coming out, but more so because it's just such a great adventure book, and it really gets you in the mood for all those, you know, summer adventures you're hoping you have.
Oh, what a great place to leave it at. Daniel, thank you so much for that recommendation.
And thank you, everybody, for calling and sharing your summer reading suggestions. You can keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page. You can find us by searching Central Time on WPR.
Coming up next, the argument for moving from race-based affirmative action to a policy that considers place instead and serves students dealing with issues like poverty or underperforming schools in their communities. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from American Transmission Company. ATC provides a pathway for power into communities throughout Wisconsin. ATC owns and operates